Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the CoinGeek Weekly live stream. I think I fudged it already. Weekly live stream. I'm your host, Kurt Wooker Jr., broadcasting live from Pittsburgh, which is not a city, but a state of mind. I'm not even in the city of Pittsburgh. And my personal safety and comfort is brought to you by Slictionary, which is also holding my tea. So thank you, Mr. Pitts, if you're watching live from somewhere across the Pitts plantation. I'm on a little bit of a vacation at the moment with the fam, and we are having a good time after the Unbounded Capital Summit that I attended last week. Big round of applause to Zach Resnick and crew over at Unbounded, who've done a really good job putting together some of these regional events a couple times a year, where you bring in investors, family office types, VC, and hedge fund guys, and just give them the red pill. Tell them about Bitcoin. Explain to them what they could be or should be doing with their time, money, efforts, expertise, and everything else. So really good event. Honestly, I've got nothing but good feedback. Met a lot of good people. Watched a lot of good presentations. You know, it just always kind of feels like, man, we're the most professional people in the space. Sure would be nice if more people knew about it. And I guess it's just doing that hard work and busting out, you know, showing up and just keeping the grind. Because, you know, one of the things that I learned a long time ago and something that sort of keeps coming up in my life is it's not about who necessarily has the best ideas or the most grandiose thing to pitch to the universe, but it's often about just continuing to show up. And if you're just going to keep going, all of a sudden people start saying, you know what? He's still here. I guess that's probably the guy I'm supposed to talk to about being a professional. So speaking of people that have been around for a long time and just kind of keep grinding, my guest today who will join us in a few minutes is Alex Favell, a guy who I guess as soon as I remember there being a sort of big block versus small block conversation, Alex was one of those guys having the big block conversation. And so it's good to have a friend who's been around for that, I don't know, 5-6 years. I guess I'll hear a little bit more about his personal story as I usually do on these shows, make everybody tell their Bitcoin story before we get into the fray. But he's just been a good guy, solid on the fundamentals, why he's in Bitcoin, why Bitcoin matters. And I'm excited to have him on the show. So we are going to play an ad, but not just yet. Don't ding me, Brandon. Brandon Ward is at the control board, so I don't have to worry about Alex Moon trying to actually sabotage me live on the air while he laughs at me in our private troll box. But Brandon, who tends to be more professional, will be cutting us to an ad. But if you, the viewer, would like to advertise with us, you can reach out to Alex Moon, who I promise will treat you better than he treats me. If you'd like to advertise, you know, floating around my head or floating around up on the screen somewhere, he'd be very happy to make a good deal with you to advertise on the show. And if you're watching now, please send across social media. Let them know that we are live with Alex Favell, where we'll be talking about his new product, which has both a digital and physical manifestation. And you can ask questions in the troll box. So if you could like, subscribe, hit the alert bell so you know every time we go live, and prepare yourselves, prepare your minds, take a few deep breaths, and we'll be right back after the ad.
What's up, guys? On the next episode of the CoinGeek Roundtable, I'll be hosting a discussion on HODL Locker and locking coins with the InLock Time feature. I'll be joined by Bitcoiner Daniel Krawitz, the co-founder of Haste Arcade, Joe DePinto, and the CDO of Smart Ledger, Greg Ward. We'll be starting at 9 a.m. Eastern on Wednesday, September 27th. Get your questions ready, as the live stream will start then and we'll address them during the stream. Can't wait to see you guys there.
Hey, Alex.
Hi, Kurt. How's it going?
Quite well. How are you?
Yeah, good. Good. Excited about the game and to talk to you about it. It's great to be here. Thanks for the invite.
So let's, for the sake of the audience, I do this with everybody, even though we all have known each other for a long time. But for anybody new, can you tell me what's your Bitcoin story? How'd you feel about it when you first heard about it? How'd you end up being a big blocker? What's your, you know, it's going to be 2 minutes or 10 minutes, if whatever you want to take with it. But let me know. How'd you get into this?
my story's kind of getting into the 10-minute range, so I probably should make a video about it at some point so that I don't have to keep on going over it. My story goes back to 2013. I'm one of those people that as soon as I saw Bitcoin, I was like, how does this work? Because I'm pretty dumb in some cases. The idea of a money that could be on my computer and I could have a file on my computer that represented money that I couldn't just copy and paste, that was just like, how does that work? So I started researching it. I was at a company called GKN as a process engineer at the time. I was researching it for about 2 weeks. And then in 2 weeks, I had a light bulb moment of, oh my God, if this works, this is going to like be bigger than the internet, because you've never been able to do money on the internet. So I was always kind of upset that I'd missed the scale that the internet brought, because it just seems sure. So obvious when you're watching it. And I saw Bitcoin as the opportunity to make sure I didn't miss it again. So I was looking for a path into Bitcoin almost immediately. I quit my job there, finished my degree, mechanical engineering, then made my way into a development studio for digital products as a product owner. Then I moved into a cryptocurrency hedge fund in Cyber Capital. This is in the Netherlands now, after meeting Craig at Arnhem and also meeting the founder of the crypto hedge fund there. But me and him had a disagreement. He was all about the altcoins. And then when the BSV fork happened, there was no way we could ever really see eye to eye on anything.
Sure.
I tried very hard to convince him that BSV was the way to do things, but some people you just can't speak to. So you got to show them. And to show them, you've got to go away and like really think about what you are trying to do before you can like have something to show people. And that is what I think Dark to Light is. But after I left the cryptocurrency hedge fund, I set up one of the few venture capital firms in investing in the BSV space called Two Hop Ventures. And we're still going, but we are fully deployed now. So we're looking for exit opportunities or, you know, whatever they might be.
For sure.
And now it's about trying to change the narrative of what BSV is and how we can actually talk to one another about these crazy topics in the world, because God knows there's a lot of them.
Yeah, no, for sure. And actually, I think the best way to learn about something is to make it fun. I actually taught a class to a bunch of, I don't even know, second to fourth or fifth graders or something this morning. It was one of the terms of me hanging out at the Pitts house, was that I had to speak at their homeschool co-op. And so I talked a bit about broadcasting. And so how do I teach, you know, 8 to 12-year-olds about, you know, here's what gravitas means and all of that. But frankly, it was like, so I've taught college level courses, but I'm talking to kids and I've never taught kids. And I realized after about 3 minutes in, like, oh, I need to be funnier, or I'm just going to lose this group. And so,
yeah, being funny is actually quite difficult. I don't think I'm very funny, but I can be at times, you know.
It was like playful gamification. I teach jujitsu, and I'm from a generation of people that drill to kill, and it's, you know, you're not working if you're not sweating. And then I came to realize, you know what? It's the same thing, like make it playful. If we make jujitsu playful, it's easier to learn too. And so I'm actually really excited about your game. I've done some research about it. I won't give my feedback on it yet. I'll let you kind of debut what is the game and how it works and the mechanics. But I think what you're actually doing is you're teaching people something by making them have fun while playing a game. And I think that's crucial.
Yeah.
Because this is how we learn. Well,
I would say play is probably the ultimate form of learning, because it's how we learn when we're a kid. That's how we absorb so much of the world so quickly. School kind of beats that out of us, and learning is no longer fun, which is unfortunate. The actual game has nothing to do with like blockchain or anything in terms of the subject matter. It's just centered around short form controversial questions. And they don't have to be controversial. So like, because this is blockchain related, but if you ask a question on our platform when we launch in November, you will be able to make royalties from your question, regardless of whether it's on the blockchain, right? Because if you ask a question on our platform and other users like it, they can get it delivered to their house and have it be part of their deck. So a question like, do you believe in God, right? May
starting out with the low controversy lines.
This is possibly one of the most important questions of the human experience. Right?
I agree, actually. I think it's the first question most people need to define if they're going to be a philosophical person at all.
Yeah, probably. But if you go onto Google in the age of information and type in how many people in the world believe in God, you get a 20% error margin from 60 to 80%. That doesn't mean we live in the age of information. We live in the age of data. If we can't get a good answer from that question, you know, you can ask that to anyone and get a data point, then what are we really doing with the technology that we're building? It seems kind of insane that that's the state of things. But then you've got really low ball questions that would have been low ball 20 years ago, like this: are there more than two genders? Right.
There we go.
So it's like, at what point does a question become valuable? It's simply when the culture has evolved to make it valuable. But that doesn't mean that every question is valuable. It's got a time period. It is a question of what kinds of questions will be the most valuable over time. And you would think that they would be religious in nature because they never have a time limit. Would be asked for, you know, centuries to come. But in terms of the gameplay, you can see how, well, a question like, can there be more than two genders, might split the room. But then a question like this, right? Can a machine be conscious? Kind of might unite the room again. So there's a way here to have really complex high-level conversations, but then also really dive deep into like who people are. So there's social questions like, do you think the people you work with are good at their job? Right. I mean, everyone can relate to that question, basically.
Sure. Everyone's got a story to tell immediately, I'm sure, about, hey, you know what, this guy I work with is incredible to work with. He does more than he's asked and makes my day great, and he's fun and funny. And then you got then there's this guy who's always, you know, the crazy guy. He's never clocks in. He shows up high.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Like whatever else. That kind of character. So the way to play the game with these questions is effectively everyone has a yes and no card, which are white because voting is, you know, coming into the light effectively. Yep. And then everyone votes in secret. So you never know how any individual has voted unless you play with them a lot and you kind of really get to know them. And then you kind of start to understand where they stand in their own perception of themselves and the world in general. So people do compare it to cards like Against Humanity because a lot of people have said it feels like an evolution of it. I would tend to agree, but Cards Against Humanity, you only ever find out about people's sense of humor and how crass they might be. This, you find out about every single subject you can imagine about people. But like I said, you're not necessarily finding out about an individual. You're finding out about the group in general.
No, that's really it's really interesting because it's kind of it's one of the key things about like Bitcoin blockchain generally that I've always thought was really important is that, you know, data itself is the valuable thing. Like blockchain helps us make it more valuable, but ultimately it's that data. And then the more data you can aggregate, the more that you can actually learn the value of anything really. And so I remember I think it was Berlin about 2 years ago now, or a little more than a year ago. You pulled me aside because you were going to give your presentation, and you let me know, like, hey, this is, it's going to be a big deal, and I really want to be on your show when this thing, you know, really, really fires up. But I think you're going to like my presentation. And I loved your presentation because it was like, just had exactly the right amount of kind of drama build up, and it almost had this quality to it initially, and then like, oh no, this is actually really exciting. But something I don't remember now because it was a while ago.
Yeah, it's an onboarding experience, which to fill people in, I went to the B2049 conference in Berlin while CoinGeek was there, and presented effectively the Figma onboarding process.
Yeah,
but because we've effectively got two, a binary option on a question, and then you come to the next one, it's kind of like, you know, you could scroll through all of the questions and just have the buttons, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. But we don't think that's a great way to collect data, simply because we don't want a bias in the way people are answering the question based on which questions you like or not. So we've elected to effectively do it like Tinder, where you have to answer the current question to see the next one. So there isn't even necessarily a search function either. And that gives us a lot of power to really control how the onboarding process works. So when you first come to the platform, the only thing you really care about is potentially seeing a question and answering it. So that's the only thing you get. And then you get the results afterwards. And every question, we start adding on elements to the screen so that you're not overwhelmed with information when you learn our product. Because at the end of the day, we've got it to the bare bones where you don't even need technology, right? It's just literally cards in your hand. So it's accessible to everyone. And I think that's one of the important things we're trying to do with Bitcoin, is make it accessible to everyone.
For sure.
And that's why I, you know, like everyone else that's making games, unfortunately, I think a lot of games have quite a short half-life, which makes it difficult to get it right. But it's it can be very lucrative if you get it right. So it's amazing to watch.
Yeah, no, it really is. It's funny you bring up Tinder, because it's one of the first things that, like, when we're talking about personality, I think the divorce statistics are something like 50%, and you know, I know that number is debated for various reasons, but the divorce rate is high in the Western world, and I think part of it is, you know, we decide to be with a person or get married based on information that is sort of trivial, like, hey, we have the same favorite band, we have the same favorite food, or you know, whatever, the kind of thing that is fleeting and changes over time. But you know, maybe we never get to the deep personality stuff until, oh shoot, we've already been married for 2 years and have a kid, and I don't want to spank my kid, or hey, I want to raise my kid at church, and I'm an atheist, you know, like, oh shoot, you know, that becomes a big problem there. And I think just something like this, like almost the gamification of learning about each other, could be a really valuable tool. Even more so than taking like your Myers-Briggs or your Enneagram and like, oh, okay, I'd be really compatible with a 6 because I'm a, you know, I'm a 8 or something. And, you know, like get one layer deeper, essentially, like get a little bit better fundamental understanding so that like that upper level can blossom better. Have you considered like what sort of opportunities the concept might be applicable to other things like that?
Yeah, quite a lot. In fact, just the other day, so as soon as you start using the internet for something, you'll start seeing it everywhere. It's just part of the way the internet works. And I actually saw an article that was like, we can replace phone numbers with a bunch of binary questions. We just need 31, because then you can effectively identify everyone on the planet from those 31 questions if they're able to answer them repeatedly the same. But the thing about this thing is that you might have a different interpretation of the question one day as opposed to the other. But the other thing is that, are you really going to – what would those questions be? Are you going to get a bunch of lab technicians down and, you know, write down some questions that you know, could potentially be used for this.
Well, right, no, you have to crowdsource it.
Yeah, the official questions. We do have official questions because we're launching the Kickstarter before the online platform. Just to things in BSV have always been difficult when it comes to raising money. So we're kind of kickstarting the business on Kickstarter, which is where you'll find a lot of these kinds of card games. It's where Cards Against Humanity started. It's where Exploding Kitten started, and a bunch of others that you'll have heard of, but you won't know that they started on Kickstarter.
Yeah, yeah. Like, what is your process been for setting up a Kickstarter? We do have kind of a lot of entrepreneurs and wannabe entrepreneurs who watch the show. How is that?
It's pretty simple. It doesn't take long to do. The most difficult thing is getting the content, and then there's also a verification and check that you're not breaking any terms and conditions. But you know, we're selling a card game, so it's pretty simple for us. If you wanted to use it for maybe what the Coom Battles is doing, I'm not sure you'd pass their sniff test. But it's very simple for us. I would encourage anyone to take a look at it. You've got to do your research though. So they give you the option of doing 60-day Kickstarters, but apparently the most optimal time is 30 days. So we've gone for that, and we've gone for a low amount to fudge the system effectively. But if you look at, because card games are such a popular thing to do on Kickstarter, there's an entire business in China that just effectively makes your Kickstarter for you and then ships it to customers. So ours is going to be pretty simple. But if you look online, there's some videos of showing their quality, and it's pretty good. You know, it's not the best thing in the world, but for the first run, I think it'll be fine. It depends on how many units we sell, right? If we sell, 20,000, then maybe, I take a trip to China and find a better manufacturer, or find one locally. I don't know.
Right.
But at the moment, the plan is just do the tried and true tested method that everyone else uses.
Sure. So, and Brandon, maybe we can get queued up a few questions here too. But I think for me, I'm curious a little bit about the some of that like manufacturing. But like, so you're using the blockchain for various parts of the data, but it can also be a standalone physical card game that can be played, in a cabin with no internet connectivity. What's the overlap? How do these interact with each other, or is it just a completely separate system?
There is an overlap, and it's the fact that our database is the questions. So the question is the Earth flat, right? Obviously, I didn't focus, but whatever. Obviously, it's one thing to ask your friends, but then what does the entire world think? Because apparently, there's a significant portion of people that believe the Earth is flat. Well, these QR codes take you to that exact question. And because a question can only be asked once, right? We get a global poll of that question. So you can imagine our polls over time will collect like 10 to 15 million votes just because people are interested in these types of questions as opposed to, I was going to say the Kardashians, but I guess a lot of people would like to know information about those as well.
Right. Yeah. What's the percentage of plastic in your typical Kardashian?
It's got to be yes or no. Is it?
Oh, 50%? Right. Okay. All right. I'm screwing with the algorithm. So, all right, let's bring up a couple of questions, Brandon. I see a few that look pretty good. Nelson asking, so how does this game use Bitcoin?
So good question, obviously. I don't like talking about it because it's not really part of the stage we're at yet. But effectively, you've got to pay to see the answer and vote. If you're in a queue for a question that pays you, you can receive money for casting your vote. So it's effectively like a anyone can spend feature, right? In that you can sponsor data collecting on one question. And you can do that as the question owner, or you can do that as a third party. And eventually, we would like to think that the questions would be tradable as well. But at the moment, we're not, we haven't got that on our roadmap. What we do have on our roadmap is a referral scheme. So if you add data to this question, you get a link that you can share on your socials, and then you'll share in half the half the revenue from that referral link.
Oh, that's, and yeah, that's really juicy, actually.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you've got a following of 1 million people, and we're charging, say, half a cent to, a tenth of a cent to answer the question, then you can see how that stacks up for people with a big following.
Yeah, for sure. No, that's really interesting. And I can see a little bit of crossover. So I'm hanging out at the Pitts house right now. So I'm thinking, it kind of reminds me like the way that Slictionary is thinking of monetizing words, or having like word bounty and some of these things, or like ownership of a word over time. It seems like a lot of those concepts could be applicable here too. Because it's definitions again. They're literally just talking about word definitions or versus concept definitions.
There's a very potentially interesting future where our two companies are API'd into one another.
And sure.
And you get votes on definitions, just like he's got, because how you define each word in a question is quite important. And people have different definitions for things, or they just simply don't understand what that thing is talking about. So they vote randomly and then move on, or potentially skip. We'll find out whether that feature will be in there during the beta, which you can only get, by the way, if you pre-order the Kickstarter.
I've been on a little bit of a vacation, but I keep trying to in between my kids screaming at me, trying to read up on and sign up for. So no, it's really
as long as you put your email address in the website or follow us on Twitter or X, then you'll definitely be informed that when we go live.
For sure. So let's bring up another couple of questions here. See if I'm able to read them while mobile. Yeah, we're good. Are games the best way to get people involved in Bitcoin?
Are they the best? I don't know. Are they the most effective? Probably. It's definitely the best way to get normal people interested in Bitcoin. Are they going to get involved in Bitcoin? Probably not. Because as we found out by trying to jam it down people's throats for the past 10 years, people have lives and they don't necessarily care about what their money is. So we'll see how games can change that. But yeah, I think games are the most effective way of doing it.
Yeah, that is an interesting problem that we've seen anyway. You know, like to the people that are money zealots or, you know, gold bugs or whatever, you're like, Bitcoin has this like a couple of immediately obvious perks, and you know, so you get the very passionate people, and normally you'd expect the very passionate people to be the ones in charge of the system for a little bit and then you trickle out. But it feels like we got to like, so we get to some level and then it's just like nobody cares. It's like the right curve, mid curve, left curve,
but
the mid curve is so tall we can't climb it.
There's a bit of an issue in Bitcoin in that the leaders often leave because it's too stressful. I don't want to be one of those people, so I'm going to be here until the end if there is an end. Because I think a lot of people in BSV act like BSV can't die, but it absolutely can, which is why we need to, you know, start acting fast. I believe that this game is definitely one way to convert people without them knowing that they've been converted. The other thing is that if anyone's worried about copycats or anything, we've got this thing under the Creative Commons license, which is kind of like open source. But we're the only ones able to commercialize it because it's our property. So, you know, if you want to take it, change it, and play it with your friends and you know, build a community, you can absolutely do that. It's just that the only way you're going to be making money through this game is by playing it on my platform.
Got it. Oh, so that's the incentive, actually.
You don't actually want a lot of different systems for this kind of thing, right? Because the whole idea is that we've all got one universal place to vote or to have a voice, and then right. that's that. You can go away and, you know, comment in other places. So, you know, we're just a voting platform, effectively, that's a bit of fun. Sure. And in effect, if you start splitting up that, then its value's decreased. But because yeah. we've got it under the Creative Commons license, it's going to be a bit more difficult for you to do.
Interesting. So what was your first inspiration on this? I mean, was it about, hey, I want to build a Bitcoin game? Or was it, hey, I want to change the world? Or, hey, I'm just interested in this data? I mean, like, I've been the nerd on all three parts of that conversation.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty direct, even for British standards, which is why I had to move to the Netherlands, because they're even more so. But being direct, you generally don't care about the reasons why people do one thing or the other. It's kind of like, okay, well, are you going to do this or not? You know, it's pretty binary. And actually, I was throwing a party, and one of my Dutch friends asked an English friend, a group of English friends, a question that he shouldn't have asked if he'd read the room properly. And I was thinking about it, of like, but it's kind of a funny question. So how do you ask that question with no one knowing you asked it, but then also how do you answer that question with nobody knowing how you've answered it? And the answer just came in scale. You know, if you have lots of questions with no names attached, and, you know, you treat the game like poker, you hide your vote, then, you know, it's pretty simple. But simple is hard. And I'm going to keep on saying that, I think, for the rest of my life.
That's a good point. I keep finding myself saying more and more that something can be simple, but not easy. And Bitcoin's one of those things. You know, you can give a 10-second definition for Bitcoin, or you give a 15-year long one and still not be super clear.
It's definitely one for the philosophers of the future, I think. You know, either why did it fail or why did it succeed so well? Yeah. Why does it work? That's probably more a scientific question than philosophy. But Bitcoin works because people are honest, and they want their reward. We do have rewards and punishments in the game as well, but that's a more advanced version. So one of the things about a lot of these card games is I find they get stale quite quickly. So you need an extra bit of flair in there to keep people coming back. Sure. And the punishments and rewards are just a way to give the game a bit more seriousness, but also as much goofiness, because, again, those are all user generated as well.
So what's an example of a punishment?
Oh, I might have to go through a few. Oh, this is a good one. Say everyone's full name or lose a point.
Or lose a point. Interesting. Yeah.
So the question cards are points. And I think if you're in a group of like five people that you kind of just know, you know, maybe for like if you're at university and you're in Freshers Week or something and you're trying to get to know people, saying everyone's full name is going to be a bit of a nightmare. As it always is. I'm never really good with names, so that's a good punishment. And then a bonus might be something like this, if you can see that.
There we go. After the prediction, but before the count or court?
Count.
Steal a
question.
Okay. Interesting.
So, like, there's an opportunity to gain more points outside of your go if you get one of these cards. And everyone starts with two boosts. So everyone has 1 point, because a boost is half a point. We've got all this written down in instructions on our website, along with a free version of the PDF. It's a lot easier if you go and read them and then give it a go. As soon as you start playing like two or three rounds, you'll start to get it. It's one of those types of situations. And because the rounds are actually pretty fast, you'll learn it in like 2 or 3 minutes. Our instructional video is going to be like 30 seconds.
Nice. Well, yeah. And that's the beauty of it, is like, even with something like Cards Against Humanity, like, you open the box and say, okay, do I want to learn how to play this? You read a couple of cards and they're like, oh, okay, these are funny at least. Like, I guess I will take a minute or two necessary to learn how to do this with my friends. But
yeah, exactly.
That's pretty great. Brandon, do you have another couple of questions here? Let's get through a few of them. Will there be a sort of tree of questions, e.g., do you believe in God, multiple gods, one God, et cetera, et cetera? I like this question. This is actually
yes.
a sharp follow-up, yeah.
This is also in our roadmap. We're calling them playlists for the moment, but we don't like that word. I mean, tree's a good suggestion. But we'll have to think about how easily understandable that is for the audience and how big that audience gets.
Yeah, actually, that could end up being like a data storage quandary with, you know, because I mean, there's lots of individual gods, there's lots of religions, and then, you know, extrapolate that out to every concept. Like, are there two genders? And if the answer is no, well, how many are there? that's
yeah, exactly. It's an interesting concept. Obviously, in the physical game, it's quite easy to have category packs, right? So that's already taken care of, but it's just that we need to know there's enough demand for the actual game before we can start going down that route. We need to first deal with the controversial questions, I guess, before we get to the more nuanced understandings of each other.
Yeah, no, for sure. You know, to that, I mean, we're talking about the Kickstarter, we're talking about kind of the schedule. You've mentioned November. What do you see as a roadmap? If everything kind of works out the way you hope it does, is it like, what does that look like?
Yeah, I hope to get the physical card games delivered before Christmas. When people are with their families, but I can't promise that. We've already been delayed a bit with the actual launch of the Kickstarter. So early next year, I would expect January. The Kickstarter launches for purchase on the 7th of October, ends the 7th of November.
Okay.
And yeah, then the online platform, the beta access will be a few days before the Kickstarter, so that people can kind of play around with it and know that we're not kind of, you know, just that's a pie in the sky vaporware. That platform doesn't actually affect the Kickstarter in any way. So, you know, it's just a little bit of a hint of, hey, you might want beta access to this by ordering some cards because it could be quite interesting to see what people's questions are before it's fully launched to the public.
Sure.
The other thing is that the beta will most likely will have to reset on public launch because of if people are using these as investments, then it gets a bit difficult. What we can do though is we can queue up all your questions and then you can select the ones that you actually want to purchase on launch day.
Yep. Cool. Question from James Marchant. Is there a funding goal on Kickstarter or X number of sales or simply a platform to launch the product?
There's a funding goal of $4,000. We're keeping it very low because that's effectively the minimum reasonable order quantity that we can get away with at the manufacturer for the scale of cards. So at the beginning of the Kickstarter, each base game will come with 250 cards or so. But for every 50% more we raise of our Kickstarter, we'll add another 10 cards. And the not safe for work version, because obviously certain questions are not for children, will be about 350 cards. But we'll increase those up until 612 cards, I think. It's the limit of our manufacturer, if there is the market for it. In terms of when we need that buy, as soon as possible. We need to cheese the Kickstarter algorithm so Kickstarter promotes it for us as well. But we're going to try our darndest on X and YouTube and stuff. We'll see how far the YouTube goes. Because we've got a trailer coming out immediately after this interview as well.
I saw that. Yeah, as soon as the stream's over, I think the trailer goes live. So maybe Brandon, can we get a link to that and maybe advertise that as we push this out on social? So let's do another question or two as well. I want to make sure we get the crowd. The crowd is interested, which bodes well for the game.
Fantastic.
Here we go. Will there be a way for players to come up with questions? I know you have the online side. Is that the way you will decide what goes out as an actual card?
The goal is to get it so that even if you want a card, you'll be able to get a card. So you'll ask the question on our platform. Maybe it performs well, maybe it doesn't. But if it doesn't perform well, the goal should be that you can still get it yourself. The one thing that I think people haven't really realized yet is that you'll be able to build your own deck effectively, and then potentially sell that on a marketplace as well. So you can select from, you know, everyone else's questions and your own, and then sell that as a package online.
Yeah. No, I like that idea, because, like, in theory, you could get a company like Tinder, for example, to make a first date edition or something like that, and, you know, just have it be, you know, just vetted relationship based, you know, not so much, you know, is the earth flat, might not necessarily want to be something you want to know on the first date, but.
Well, I don't know, depending on what the answer is, I think I'd probably quite like to know that, you know.
Sure. Well, I mean, it almost reminds me of, like, old school game shows, which I used to watch, like The Dating Game, for example, where it'd be like, you know, what's an ideal date for you? And you get to hear these ridiculous answers from frankly ridiculous people. But but it is, it's just that kind of fun. It's like a little bit voyeuristic. It's a little bit fun. Like, you're looking, you know, maybe just like one inch behind the curtain too far into people's personal lives. But then it's like, oh, okay, it's all for good fun. Everybody consented. And that's,
yeah. The other thing is that people can lie. Right. I mean, no one's looking over your shoulder, making sure that you're telling the truth, which actually brings in bluffing to the game as well, because you get a point if you guess what the group voted correctly. If someone doesn't want you to get a point, then maybe they lie about it. Or maybe in certain situations, everyone lies just to throw you off. But then you know that people are going to lie, so you change your answer.
That's actually, so that's the other interesting thing about these kind of games, is when they go viral, you start getting people who are going to play, like, they'll play some, like, maybe they'll call it like cursed edition, where, like, everybody's goal is to lie. And that's like the tournament rules or that kind of thing. And I really love just how, like, low level, like, kind of building block this concept is, which then lets it blossom in a bunch of different directions.
It's kind of strange that because every time I've shown it to people, they kind of start imagining how the other things that you could do with it, either the online platform or the physical game. So I do believe that it could generate quite a lot of organic activity. So we're quite excited about that.
Yeah, for sure. Another one from Mr. Bachman here. As a gamified voting platform, can groups eventually use it to pull their audience?
Yes, 100%. So every time you ask a question, you get a link to that question, and then you can post it on your socials. If you own a question, you'll see how it's divided up between the links that are generated and posted around, but only if you own it. If you own a link to a question that without owning the question, you'll see how that audience is broken down. So there's you can poll your own audience without getting confused with everyone else. But the general sort of goal is to have it so that you're asking high level questions that you hope get to millions upon millions of people. But you know, people will use it for whatever they want to.
Yeah. Absolutely. So we've got, we will ask this question here about owning questions and stuff, but we've got a little over 10 minutes left right now. So I want to make sure, is there anything specific that you really wanted to cover that maybe I haven't organically approached in my questioning that you want the audience to know?
No, not really. I think you've taken a good path to it. The number of questions is just so vast that, you know, we could talk about it forever. And it's one of those things that as soon as you start thinking about it, you can't really stop. At least that's how I felt about it. I would say that actually I had a sort of similar idea, a fleeting thought, I think like 7 or 8 years ago, thinking about Bitcoin, going, well, does this mean we're going to get sort of like a direct democracy thing where we can just vote on every topic we want? I thought too. Yeah, well, it turns out that, yeah, we could do, but is that really a good idea? Because, well, this game is kind of the experiment of that. I'm not going to say that we should rule ourselves by this silly little game, but that's kind of what people are expecting, I guess.
Sure. Let's get back to the questions from the crowd, please, Mr. Ward. How much will it cost to own a question?
50 cents and 1 cent per character, up to a limit of 123 cents. So that is a maximum charge of $1.73. But I've found that most questions that I want to ask are under a dollar.
Cool. And is that based on a character limit?
The tech field? The character limit really forces you to be very specific and general at the same time. It feels a little like being a lawyer, which is kind of strange. But I think there is a skill level to this, and it's going to be very interesting to see what kind of questions people come up with. Because, I've written all my questions. I'm not too interested in them anymore. I want to see what everyone else's questions are.
Yeah. Actually, what was the process to make the original deck? Was this primarily you? Was it you and a couple of buddies?
No. The primary game is actually here in the background. This was the first prototype. So we just got a punch bowl and asked questions and rolled them up.
Awesome.
Right. And this isn't even all of them. We've got two of these things. And, just very basic yes or no cards on card. And then it morphed into this one and then this one. And I've only ever had one box through the entire thing that we use as a voting box. And that's effectively what you're going to be using the packaging for. That's the other thing about this game, is that the packaging is actually useful. You use it as a ballot box.
Yeah. Love it. No, that's really cool. Another one from James. Any magic on the back end to track popular or common questions but phrased slightly differently?
No. So the best example of that is this question, which we start the interview with. Do you believe in God? Right. Yeah. The capital G would suggest a God, not the God, not a God. So a monotheistic thing. So we don't want to limit the types of questions people can ask just because of the way they're written. So effectively, this will be the tool you use to ask a question many, many different ways if you want to get the true answer.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, that's an interesting problem. I could see lots of people misspelling a name like Kardashian, for example, and then you have what's essentially the same question, but with a misspelling or a capitalization or something. At some point, that's got to merge, or does that not matter in your...
It doesn't really matter, because if you're looking to make money, right, you're going to ask the question correctly, because we're not going to print necessarily an official card game with spelling errors in it.
Sure.
You want this question to be seen by as many people as possible. And since every question has a QR code on it, right, you're then advertising your question to those people. So...
Right.
You want to close that loop by asking the question correctly. I'm sure people will do this kind of thing, but I imagine these questions will fizzle out very quickly.
Right. That's an interesting dilemma. Mr. Ward, do we have any more questions you'd like to pull up here? I saw that there's star, but now that I'm mobile, it's a little harder to read. Okay, no more questions. It's all me and you, Mr. Favel. So
that's all right.
So let's talk about things let's say you raise $10 million on Kickstarter by the middle of November. What does this look like in 6 months if you just have an exceptionally successful Kickstarter campaign?
Well, how many units would that be? That would be about 500,000 units. So it's probably enough to audit a election the size of the US's.
Yeah.
And when I say audit, I mean, if you don't believe the results, go to the town hall and just ask a bunch of questions related to the election. It doesn't have to be which candidate did you vote for. It can be, what's the general feeling of people.
Right. Well, that's an interesting thing. Talking about something like direct democracy, which is you know, on the one hand, like really cute for a civics class to say, well, we could just, what if we all voted on everything? What if technology makes we don't need, you know, representative democracy or whatever. But
if you voted on everything, you'd be voting until you're dead.
Well, nothing's exactly.
Change.
Well, and then you get the same problem you get with like something like Reddit, where it's, you have the self-appointed, like, hey, I'm the genius here. And then you get the people who are, I'm going to let the smart people decide. That it's kind of, I think that's probably what Pareto principle, like 80% of the work is done by 20% of the people or something like that. But
yeah. And the reward tends to go to 20% of the people that aren't the 20% of the people doing the work.
Right. So yeah, create a bunch of proxies. Another question, Alex Vidal asking, what has been the most interesting part about building this game? It's a good question. This is, it's been at least 2 years now. What's your...
I mean, the most difficult part has been finding a developer. So I'm working with Shirish. Many people in the BSV community know him already. But the most interesting part, that's a good question. I'd probably say playtesting it with absolute random strangers. Just because people, like I said, after two or three rounds, people immediately kind of get it. And, you know, if you're in a bar, and some of the more adult questions come up, people get even more kind of interested because they're like, oh, I can use this as a tool to get laid kind of thing.
Right.
But it's not even necessarily that. It's just, you know, finding out, you know, what percentage of the group is available or dating or whatever, you know, and you don't have to know specifically who.
Yeah. Well, actually, it kind of brings up, I'm a media man at heart, but I think I'm picturing sort of man on the street, like ambush interviews. Like that could be a fun, like, hey, do you want to play a game? Like it'll take 30 seconds. Some, you know, you can get really good content out of that.
Yeah, you can do that kind of thing. Typically those interviews are only with one person, but there's people standing around them because, you know, people tend to go out together. Right. So you'd have to kind of nab three groups of two or three people. And then there's a bit of setup required, but you know, it's a case of just getting out and doing it. I might do that. We'll see how the video is received, because I think those kinds of videos will do really well on TikTok. So I'll probably have to get out there.
Yep. Or even, I mean, yeah, just having a channel where people are playing like tournament style essentially, and it can be its own streaming content, like home base, basically. It could be really
good. Yeah, we're actually having a playtest of it with some of the... Well, I said playtest, but I mean, it's a finalized game now. We're having a playthrough in Utrecht in the Netherlands with the BSV people.
I've never
heard of it. it's a quite a large town, if it's not city, south of Amsterdam.
Okay, cool. That's exciting. Mr. Ward, I see a few more questions have spilled in. Any worth going after, or should we cover something separate to wrap up here? Because we got about 2 minutes. Just people saying hi. So that's nice. Hi, people. If you're watching, thanks for watching. And thanks for putting up with the little bit of technical difficulties had on this episode, which isn't common. I was actually worried about my internet more than anything, given that I don't usually broadcast from someone's home, but the internet's been rock solid. My problem was actually my equipment. So that's, you know, classic, frankly. Alex, closing stuff, like where can we learn more? I think Brandon can put up the link to the YouTube video that'll be live as soon as we end the stream in about...
I think he already has in the chat. So the stream, it actually starts at 10 past because I thought you might go over, but considering we've had technical glitches, I think we'll end on time. The best way to keep up to date is give us your email on the website. And we'll let you know of everything that's important. I'm not going to sell your email. That's actually in our terms and conditions. So don't worry about that. I've already got something to sell you. I don't need to sell it to someone else.
Yeah. No. Amen, man. Closing words before I cut you loose?
No. Thank you very much for having me. It's been great. I'll see you again very soon, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Thank you, Alex. Means the world. Glad to have... a guy that's frankly become an old friend back on the show doing something cool. So
anytime. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. All righty. So, sans the technical difficulties, it's a little weird talking into the small camera on my phone while I wrap up the show here. But if you have stuck with us through it, I appreciate you. I appreciate the constant kindnesses and the loyalty. And I would also appreciate your likes, subscriptions, and hittings of the alert bell. So if you could go ahead and do that, let the world know that you are a fan and a friend. Let them know that we had an interesting show about a frankly really cool project that would be awesome to share with the world. You can share this across social media. Let them know that we're doing some big things and that some big things are debuted on the CoinGeek Weekly live stream. So per usual, it has been a pleasure and an honor. And I remind you to be good to each other, even and maybe especially when it's harder than usual. There's always something in the background going on, you know, some little devil whispering in your ear about all the ways you can screw your way to the top or you know, kill a couple of people to make your way to you know, having new friends or that kind of thing. And that's always the temptation that the world gives us. But you know, as we can see, just like build something fun, build something that people want to play, build something that makes people's lives objectively better, and then we can get really successful while bringing a bunch of people with us. I've always been a big believer in the axiom that rising tides raise all ships. So if you'd like to raise ships together by being good to each other, then I appreciate your subscriptions and your viewership. So everybody, I'm Kurt Wickert Jr. saying thank you. Be good to each other, and also enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. So I will talk to you later. Thank you, everybody, and goodbye.
What's up, guys? On the next episode of the CoinGeek Roundtable, I'll be hosting a discussion on HODL Locker and locking coins with the InLock Time feature. I'll be joined by Bitcoiner Daniel Krawitz, the co-founder of Haste Arcade, Joe DePinto, and the CDO of Smart Ledger, Greg Ward. We'll be starting at 9 a.m. Eastern on Wednesday, September 27th. Get your questions ready, as the live stream will start then, and we'll address them during the stream. Can't wait to see you guys there.